Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown, and today I am talking to John Hibbing and John Alford, who are two of the authors of the very interesting new book, Predisposed, Liberals, Conservatives, and the Biology of Political Differences. John and John, how are you both doing today? Maybe I can start with John. John Hibbing, how are you doing today?
I'm fine, Heath. Thanks very much for having us.
Wonderful. And John Alford, maybe I can start with you and give you the chance to introduce yourself just a little bit, who you are, where you are now, and anything else you'd like to share.
I'm John Alford. I'm at Rice University in Houston, Texas. And John Hibbing and I met up in graduate school at University of Iowa and have been doing research on and off ever since.
Great. And John Hibbing, how about yourself? Where are you now?
I am at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. I'm in the Department of Political Science with a courtesy appointment in psychology. I've been here about a little over 30 years now.
Okay, wonderful. And the other author who isn't with us is Kevin Smith, who is also with you at Nebraska, John?
Yes, he's right down the hall, but he's recently become chair of the department, so he seems to think he's too important for events like this.
Well, he is forgiven, and he contributed mightily to the book, so we can appreciate that. Let's talk a little bit about the writing of the book. John Alford, you allude a little bit to how you guys got together, and some of it is the obvious connections at the institution. But maybe you guys could talk just a little bit about the history of this collaboration. How long in the making is this book? Was there an initial idea that you're pursuing, or is this a long and well-established collaboration? And John Hibbing, would you like to maybe start?
Okay. It's difficult to know how far back to go. As John mentioned, he and I were graduate students together. So we were looking at things like congressional elections for a long time and public opinion. And I think 10, 15 years ago, we were each a little bit dissatisfied. We thought maybe some of the questions were not being answered fully just because of traditions in the discipline. So it turned out that each of us had been reading outside the discipline in areas such as evolutionary psychology and genetics and physiology. And we kind of sheepishly mentioned it. I don't know who said it first to the other, but it turned out that we each had been going down the same path. So one thing led to another, and we thought this shouldn't be something we're doing on the side. We should address it a little bit more directly and hopefully get the discipline to think more broadly about some of these issues. And Kevin was kind of in a similar boat. He's a little younger than we are, so we didn't find out about his interest a little bit later. But since he was right down the hall from me, conversation over a beer, one thing led to another, and we realized that the three of us had a lot of shared interests.
Yeah, and the result is a really interesting book and nuanced and touches on so many things. Before we get to what your contribution is, John Alford, I wonder if you can describe a little bit about what this is a response to, kind of the common cliched narrative that maybe we see on TV or we see repeated in other settings about these differences between liberals and conservatives. What's the common notion that you guys try to push a little further and poke some holes at and contribute science to what's sometimes not a very scientific discussion?
Well, I think we're really reacting to two things. One is sort of very broadly accepted and very old tradition in political science and the social sciences as well, that behavior, adult human behavior, is almost entirely the result of environmental effects, whether those are early childhood socialization effects, you know, your parents, the schools you go to, or later life experiences, the kind of job you end up at, the friends you make as an adult, your later life experiences. So we're trying to provide some balance to that. Our view is that environmental effects are important, but that they're not the universal explanation for all of social behavior, and particularly for all of political behavior. At the same time, we're also reacting a bit to something you see maybe a little more recently and a little more in the popular media, which is a notion that genes are almost directly responsible for just about everything about adult individuals. And so we're really looking at a kind of middle ground in which we take seriously the notion that there are both environmental and genetic effects, and in particular that the real fruit for current exploration is in the area of trying to understand the biology of human political behavior, more than trying to explore its detailed genetic origins or fighting the nature-nurture battle. We want to start with the assumption that there is some role for nature in this process, and then we want to try to get to work on understanding that biology of political behavior.
One of the ways that people typically think about this is to focus on brain and brain research. But your book shows that there are other physiological differences that are important, that matter. What are these, and how do they relate to politics? John Hibbing, what more than brain research did you guys look at to try to contribute to this area?
Well, you're certainly right. You need to conceptualize this not just as the brain, but as the entire nervous system. So we look at things that range from, you know, cognitive traits, like what kinds of things we pay attention to and how we process various new information, to more physiological reactions and even endocrine levels. So what's your cortisol level? How does your cortisol respond to a stressful situation? What happens when you see an image that's maybe disgusting or threatening? Does your skin conductance go up? Does your sympathetic nervous system seem to kick in? We've done that, and we've also done some brain imaging work as well. So you're right, we like to take a somewhat broader and Catholic approach to thinking about these very basic changes that occur when we conceptualize politics and respond to all kinds of stimuli.
Yeah, let's talk about at least one of the things that you do in the book. You do a lot of different things. And you do rely on some of the methods that psychologists have often used. You refer to the flanker test. I wonder if you would describe what the flanker test is, how you used it, and, you know, sort of basically what you found from it.
Well, I'll take that one. The flanker task is when you show an image to a research subject, and that's called the target image because it's in the center of the screen. And then you introduce some flanking images, one on each side. And sometimes those flanking images are the same. So the target image might be a smiling face. If it's a congruent flanker, then both of the images on the sides are also smiling. But they can also be incongruent. And what you're testing for is the extent to which being incongruent slows you down. And it's long been known that that does happen. One of the things that we found, and this is a good illustration of the differences between liberals and conservatives, is that conservatives tend to be so locked in on a face that is threatening or angry that it doesn't matter what the flanking images are. And that's a very unusual finding. Usually those flanking images make a difference. But to us, this illustrates the tendency of some people in the population, in this case those who have somewhat conservative political beliefs, to focus very strongly on the negative aspects of the environment.
And many of the findings contribute to this idea that there are these differences between liberals and conservatives. When we look at this, how true is this of elected officials? You know, many of these experiments are done with just individuals in the population. But how much of your argument extends also to those that are in positions of power? What is there a connection? What is the connection to be made between these, you know, our elected elites and just the rest of us?
Well, I think we definitely share physiological predispositions. I do think elites are much more intellectually engaged in the details of politics and policy. And so I think you would expect in that setting that there is more maybe differentiation from their physiological predisposition than you would expect for an average member of the electorate, where politics is a kind of peripheral concern. At the same time, I think people, even elites, recognize in themselves that kind of predisposition. You'll hear politicians say, you know, I'm conservative all the way to my DNA, and I think they may be right. And I also hear, you hear people say about others, it's in vogue these days in the Tea Party, for example, to talk about someone and say, well, they're, you know, they're not really a conservative. And I think in part what they mean by that is that their conservatism of someone, John Cornyn in Texas, for example, is Tea Party is challenging him. And there's an argument that maybe he's an intellectual conservative but isn't really a real conservative. And I think part of what people mean by that is that they don't get the sense that this person is sort of instinctively conservative as opposed to intellectually conservative. And I think that notion of a kind of deep instinctive gut conservatism or liberalism is really what we're getting at with the notion of predisposition.
Yeah, and maybe we can talk a little bit more about that, your title, Predisposed, and this idea. Are these Tea Party advocates right when they make this assertion? Not about the specifics, whether John Cornyn himself is or is not, but about these predispositions. How deep does this go, and what does it mean to be predisposed towards being a liberal or being a conservative?
Well, it probably won't surprise you to hear that I think, you know, these things do run very deep. That's the whole idea of a predisposition. It doesn't mean that they're not changeable. We all know people who have done a kind of 180 with regard to their political beliefs, but I think it's interesting to note how rare that is. And I like to think of these things as set points, which is a common phrase in psychology, that we tend to have a happiness set point. And this can bounce around depending on what happens to you over the course of a lifetime. But generally is the case that people who are kind of upbeat are usually that way throughout their lives. So I see it the same way with regard to politics, that we have these predispositions that are physiologically instantiated that push us one direction or the other. And it can be bounced around. Maybe a searing event occurs, such as 9/11, can change political beliefs. But failing that, and even sometimes in spite of that, I mean, a lot of the people who changed their beliefs after 9/11 are now coming back to where they were before. They're returning to their set point. So these things do run deep, but that doesn't mean they're completely unchangeable.
I thought right at the beginning of the book, you described some of the reaction to your earlier publications around similar research and some of the emails and correspondences you had with people who were almost disappointed by this, that they kind of like the feeling they have that their opponents simply are wrong or bad people. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the response, you know, your audience has, students have had, to these notions. What do people make of your argument?
Well, I know at least a few students I've had who were uncomfortable with their own ideology found this interesting. You know, if you're out of sync with the ideology of your family, for example, and again, we traditionally believe that family socialization is such an important part of where ideology comes from, that if you have liberal parents and ended up being conservative, or conservative parents and end up being liberal, that's a source of considerable tension. The parents are wondering where they went wrong, and the offspring are, you know, feeling some guilt about, you know, sort of where they are. Sometimes even reluctant to even tell their parents exactly what their ideological inclination is. And I had one student who likened it basically to coming out, that he was, you know, he finally admitted to his parents that he was a liberal. And that was a difficult thing to do. I had another student, a gay student, who was also very conservative. And he had an issue with most of his friends recognized that he was, you know, born gay. They didn't think he was making a choice to be gay. But they had much more difficulty absorbing the notion that he would, as I said, choose to be conservative when he knew that in current politics, conservative interests and gay interests weren't always aligned. And so he found it interesting to be able to respond to them that he was, you know, he didn't choose to be gay, but he also didn't choose to be conservative. And so maybe they should show the same respect for his predispositions in politics that they showed for his sexual preference.
The three of us have sometimes joked that we're still looking for a constituency, because what we mean by that is liberals tend to be bothered by these ideas because they'd like to believe that everything is about the human condition is completely malleable. And conservatives tend to think that we're just a bunch of liberal academics who are out to show that conservatives are somehow, you know, genetically or biologically flawed. And I think ideology aside, you just get most people who want to believe that their political beliefs are really purely rational and very sensible responses to the world around them. So I think the notion that maybe part of our beliefs are not quite that rational and conscious is a little bit off-putting. The three of us have spouses who are very strongly political, and each of them has expressed some reservations about just the way we are maybe a little bit more dispassionate, because we're willing to look at the people who disagree with us politically and say, well, you know what, they have different predispositions. And Heath, you were right that does kind of take away some of the fun of it. Early on, we had a lady email us, and she said, don't do this to me. I need to hate conservatives. So that's something that's always stuck in our minds.
Right. And John, you're right. You authored this very interesting blog sort of related to this. And this really does get down to what we make of these findings. You write towards the end of the book, in your conclusion, I think, and I quote, "We recommend not wasting your breath on those who are predisposed to political positions that run opposite of yours." You then note that this is a depressing advice. So what's the silver lining? What do we make of the advice you're giving, not to spend a whole lot of time trying to convince people who aren't going to be convinced? What do we make of that, and what's the silver lining that you offer towards the end of the book?
Well, I think at least part of that is there is a utility in recognizing that the solution to, for example, our current problems of polarization or a lack of civility are not going to be solved by things magically going away, that some notion of a melting pot or that we'll all meet in the middle somewhere, that, you know, the recognition that people are predisposed in quite differently and therefore view the political world very differently. It's an important recognition that that's not going to change, and that that's not the goal of political discourse, to basically find either way to meet in the middle or to change everyone's mind. You can continue to have, I think, much more useful discussions about how you can reach some kind of agreements with regard to policies if you just skip the step of assuming that policy agreement will come by first homogenizing our basic political beliefs.
Yeah, the book overall is just really interesting. I think it's interesting as a political scientist. I can imagine people teaching this in classes to try to give this perspective. What's up next from you guys, John Hibbing? What's your next project? Will it be the result of this collaboration, or are you working on something a little different for us?
Oh, a couple of things. I guess one that may be of interest is that we're shifting gears a little bit from trying to figure out why some people are liberal and some are conservative to why some are really into politics, regardless of where they are on the political spectrum. And some, on the other hand, are just completely apathetic, and they don't understand what all the fuss is about. So I think this is important because sometimes people read our research and think we're just saying there are only two types of people. And we recognize there are lots of people in the middle and lots of nuances to these things. But one of the other groups of people besides strong ideologues are those that just don't really get the excitement about politics. So we'd like to understand the biological constitution of those individuals as well.
And John Alford, how about yourself? Is there a new book project on the horizon for you?
There is something on the horizon, but we're not allowed to speak about it. It makes the controversy surrounding this book will seem like a preschool compared to the follow-up book. But in terms of the research, another area that I think is something that we look forward to having a better understanding of in the next few years, we found sort of pieces of or parts of ideology to be explained by parts of physiology. So we talk about threat and things like national defense conservatism or disgust and things like conservatism or liberalism on issues like gay marriage. But clearly there is something that's binding these things together, because we know there's a general left-right continuum. And I think that's something we really don't have much of a handle on, is how these sort of seemingly independent physiological systems for different areas of ideology tend to get correlated into what we think of as the kind of broad left-right continuum.
Well, John, that may be the best teaser for an upcoming book as I've ever heard. Thankfully, we have your current book, Until That Comes Our Way, Predisposed Liberals, Conservatives, and the Biology of Political Differences, published this year by Routledge. Both Johns and Kevin Smith are the authors. Thank you both for your time. Thank you very much for the book as well.
Thank you, Heath.
Very much our pleasure.